From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It may be the foundation of religious faith in the Western world, but the Rabbi Harold Kushner says the Bible doesn't really tell us all that much about God. Kushner says it's not like the Iliad, for example, where we learn a lot about the moods and the quarrels of the Greek gods. But there is one place where you can learn a good deal about the nature of God. It's in the book of Job. Kushner calls it a full-length argument about whether God lets bad things happen to good people. Job was a good person, one of the best. Today in the program, we continue our series about the nature of God. Rabbi Kushner will join us. He says if we want to believe this is a moral world, we're going to have to confront the arguments in Job, the most challenging book in the Bible. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let me reset the concept for a series on the nature of God. Today in the program, we're continuing that series. And it all began as a way of processing what had happened at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, or why it happened. Why does God allow suffering and tragedy? Now, the question doesn't work for those who don't believe in a God, of course, as we learned a few weeks ago in our conversation with the scientist and atheist Richard Dawkins. But for those who do believe in some kind of God, how does he or she or it work? Does God intervene in people's lives? What are the conditions under which God does step in? When does God back off? What's his relationship with humankind? Can we ever really know his will? Can we ever really account for anything God does? Today in the program, we've asked the Rabbi Harold Kushner to join us to offer his perspective on some of those difficult questions, and we're hoping to hear from you as well. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Harold Kushner is Rabbi Laureate of Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts. It's just outside of Boston. His many books include When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and more recently, Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World. And Rabbi Kushner is joining us today from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. And Rabbi, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for reaching all the way across the country so that you and I can share some conversation on this very important topic.
Good. Well, let me begin this way. I suppose when things like the shootings in Newtown happen, do you work these questions over in your mind again and again?
Well, this is not exactly news. No, Newtown is another case. I remember my response very clearly. It was on a Friday afternoon. We were getting ready for the Sabbath when I heard this terrible news. And my response was not, why does this happen? My response was, oh, no, not another incident like that. This is awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, my heart went out to these bereaved parents and families. But from a religious point of view, my response was not, why does God permit this? But how does God help us respond to it?
Mm-hmm.
The Hebrew Bible has two words to translate that translate why. There's the word madua, which means why, from what cause, and the word lama, which means why, to what purpose. And I think those are two very different ways of responding to an event in anybody's life. Why did it happen, or what am I supposed to do about it?
Right.
And I have always felt that the authentic religious response is not to explain but to respond, not to try to make sense of Newtown. The fact is it doesn't make sense.
Right.
It would be a travesty. It would be blasphemy to make sense of it. I have a lot of trouble with anybody who says God has his reasons for letting this happen and it's not up to us to question God.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, not why, but where is God in this case?
Yeah.
And my answer is, God is the one who inspired all those people to come out and sit with their bereaved neighbors and dry their tears and hug them. When, as readers of my books know, my wife and I had a child who died at age of 14 mm-hmm. of one of the world's rarest diseases. And he spent his whole life dying, and we spent his whole life knowing that he would die in his early teens. And I had to ask myself, why is God letting this happen to us? And the answer I came up with is God is not in the genetic flaw that caused the disease. As I would say to the parents of Newtown, God is not in the mind of this crazed, angry, deranged shooter. God is the one who gives us the ability to respond, to survive, to reach out to the afflicted. Had somebody said to my wife and myself on New Year's Day 1963, before my wife was even pregnant, "Before this year is out, you will have a child with the following health problem. And this is what it'll mean to your family, and this is what it'll mean to your marriage and to your job. Can you handle that?" I know that on New Year's Day 1963, my wife and I would have said, "Please don't test us. We know our limits. That's more than we can take. Don't ask us to deal with that." But, you know, for us, as for parents in Newtown, as for parents in so many places in Colorado and in Michigan, these things come into our lives without our permission being asked first. Mm. And the real response was, how on earth did we ever survive that? The answer is we found qualities of faith and love and strength in ourselves that we did not think we possessed. We found qualities in our neighbors, reaching out to grieve with us, to hold us, hug us, dry our tears, not to judge us and not to pity us, but to give us the strength we needed. That, I think, is the essential answer to the question why. Mm. You know, at the very end of the book of Job, when God appears, he has some other things to say to Job, but after God has spoken, Job says something which is not always appreciated, but I think it's one of the keys to understanding the book. He says, "I had heard of you, God, by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eyes have seen you, and I have no further questions." What he is saying is, it's Martin Buber, the great Jewish theologian, made a distinction between theology and religion. Theology is doing what you and I are doing now, talking about God.
Yeah.
We sit around, we say, you know, is God immanent or whatever the opposite is? Is God all-powerful or limited? Does God hear prayers? And at the end, we come up with an answer that we're comfortable with, but God is under no obligation to live up to our conclusions. That's theology. Theology is talking about God. Religion is actually experiencing God, feeling God's presence in your life. A disciple of Buber's says the distinction between theology and religion is like the distinction between reading a menu and having dinner. Theology can be interesting, it can be enlightening, it can be informative. It does not nourish the soul. Only the actual contact with God nourishes the soul. So what I hear Job saying in chapter 41 at the end of the book is, for the last 40 chapters, my friends and I have been arguing about the nature of God without any of us knowing anything about God. But now God has deigned to come down and touch me and speak to me. And he hasn't answered my questions, but he's answered a much more important question. He's told me that he is there and he cares. And that makes all of these theological discussions irrelevant.
Rabbi, I wanted to get a sense of how you've come to think, to be thinking about all of this, or how you've come to think the way you do, because you've been thinking about this a long time. You write in your book, the Book of Job, when bad things happen to a good person, that you were this young assistant rabbi. This is nearly 50 years ago now, father of a young child at the time and a student, and you had had to decide this subject for a dissertation you were writing. And at the time, you wanted to write about the role of God in human tragedy, I guess essentially this question, and the way that's portrayed in the Bible. But your professor said you weren't ready to write about that subject.
And he was absolutely right. I was about, 25 or so at the time. I waited till I was 75. And I had lived and I had gone through things and I had held the hands of many people suffering and I had visited people's bedsides in hospitals. And I became an authority on human suffering the hard way. And for me, the role of God was not an abstraction. It was something I encountered every day and every week. The choice I had to face was, do I have to accept all these tragedies as somehow being God's will, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, and spend the rest of my life being angry at God, pretending to be a rabbi, pretending to lead services? Or do I give up on God and just leave the rabbinate, or can I come to some resolution, which ultimately is what I think God guided me to do? But the whole enterprise rose or fell on the question of what everything that was God's will. I remember, it was 1985. My wife and I saw this movie about C.S. Lewis, the great Oxford Don and theologian, spokesman for traditional Christianity in 20th century United Kingdom. The movie begins seeing Lewis give a lecture on why God permits suffering. And he says, pain is the chisel that God uses to perfect us. God makes us suffer so that we will become the people that we are capable of being. Okay, great talk. He convinces a lot of people, comforts them. I'm not enjoying this, but it's part of God's plan for me. Then in the movie, Lewis, who had been a lifelong bachelor, meets and falls in love with a young American divorcee by the name of Joy Davidman. They marry. They are blissfully happy for many years. And then Joy comes down with bone cancer, and there's nothing they can do to save her. Seeing the woman he loves so deeply suffering and in agony with terminal bone cancer, Lewis can no longer believe what he has spent his adult life teaching people. He can no longer say pain is the chisel God uses to perfect us. He has to say, I no longer believe what I once believed. The riddle of why God permits suffering is one we will never answer. Now, I know what a hard process that was for him because I went through something very similar. I used to believe that when bad things happen to good people, it's because we don't understand the situation. We don't see how this will turn out to be good in the long run. Faced with a situation in my own family where there simply was no acceptable basis for saying that, I had to throw that out. I had to do what Lewis did and say, I can't teach that anymore. The difference between me and him is I was able to come up with a substitute answer. Namely, there are some things in life that God does not control. And that's the answer I find in the last chapter of Job, whether the author put it there or not.
Which gets to, you know, this is interesting. So the idea is that, are you saying that in some way we have to acknowledge that God is bound by natural law or bound by certain things?
I'd phrase it a little bit differently.
Okay.
What I'm saying is I believe in a self-limiting God.
Okay.
I believe in a God who at the outset said, there are two areas of experience in which I will not exercise control, though theoretically I could, but that's not the kind of world I want.
Yeah.
One is human freedom. Do I want to be a good person or a bad person? Do I want to be honest or do I want to cheat? Do I want to help people or do I want to hurt people? If every time a person made a wrong decision, a cruel decision, I came down and made it impossible. If every time a crazed teenager wanted to fire an assault rifle at young children, I made sure the rifle did not work, this would be a world without goodness and without badness. I want a world where goodness happens only if people choose it. That's my understanding of the Garden of Eden story, which is probably worth another hour to talk about some other time.
Right.
I want a world where human beings can do what no other creature can do, choose to be good. Every other living thing on the planet is bound by its instincts. Only human beings can override instinct. They can choose to be generous or selfish, choose to be honest or deceitful, choose to be helpful or unhelpful. And if they're good, they get an immense amount of credit for rising to the level almost of being godlike. That's one area, human choice. The other area is laws of nature. Laws of nature are going to treat good people and bad people alike. On the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, I was invited to go to New Orleans, speak in the largest house of worship still standing in the lower Ninth Ward. And what I said to the congregation that evening, I took my sermon from the text of First Book of Kings, chapter 12. Elijah, it's a terrible time in North Israel. Elijah runs off to Mount Sinai to reconnect with God. And there the Bible tells us, and there was a mighty wind, but God was not in the wind. And there was an earthquake, but God was not in the earthquake. And there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. And then there was a still, small voice giving Elijah an agenda of things he should go back to Israel and try and do. And I said to the people of New Orleans, where was God 1 year ago tonight? God was not in the flood. that washed away your homes. God was not in the deluge that ruined this neighborhood. God was in the courage of some of your neighbors to go out in their rowboats and rescue people off the rooftops. God was the one who motivated thousands of college students to give up their spring break to spend that time mopping the streets of New Orleans instead of partying in Fort Lauderdale. God was the one who will give you the strength to overcome these terrible things that happened to you and not be broken by them. God did not send the flood. That was nature. Nature is not moral. God is kind. Nature is blind. God is moral. Nature is not moral. Two areas, then, from which human beings suffer. Then the question is not, why does God permit it? The question is, what are you going to do about it?
But why isn't the question, why does God permit it? Why isn't it the question that God doesn't – why can't I ask, why does God permit nature to engulf hundreds of people or thousands of people?
Yes, you can ask that question. I asked that question. I asked it about the flood, and I asked about our genetics, and I asked about the San Francisco earthquake. And the conclusion I came to is, if I could come up with an answer to that question, I would be superior to God. I would be making God the subject, and I am the authority on that subject. I don't want to be superior to God. I need a God who is greater than I am. I need a God who overwhelms my ability to understand things. But I need to know which side God is on when tragedy strikes. For me, that is the key. Is this something God wanted to happen? Or is this something that God said from the creation, the moment of creation of the world, it grieves me to see it happen, but I will not prevent it? Which is why what I ultimately came to believe. That gave me a God I could love and a God I could turn to rather than a God I could only fear and resent.
Rabbi Harold Kushner is with us. His latest book is The Book of Job, When Bad Things Happen to a Good Person. And we hope you'll join us as well. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series that asks the question, why a loving God, if there is a God, would let bad things happen to good people. We're using today, a part of our subject anyway, the book of Job in the Bible. Joining us to talk about it is Harold Kushner, Rabbi Laureate of the Temple of Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts, joining us from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. His book, one of his books is called The Book of Job, When Bad Things Happen to a Good Person. So, Rabbi Kushner, I wanted to ask you, wanted to get into some sort of a basic understanding of the Book of Job or the books of Job, maybe it's better to say. It's interesting that you point out that the Bible doesn't actually tell us a lot about God, which it's interesting you say that that's different from like Homer's Iliad, which gives us a lot of sense about the Greek gods, their quarrels and their dispositions. But we don't learn anything in most of the Bible about God's private life or his, or the way his mind works, I guess. It's interesting. So the Book of Job, the books of Job are unique in that way.
Well, it's probably one of the latest books of the Bible. And by that time, the Jews, the Israelite kingdom had been destroyed by the Babylonian Empire. The Jews were scattered. They came in contact with other faiths. Certainly the Zoroastrian faith, by the time Job was written, maybe even a little bit of Greek psychology. You know, there was that axial moment in 500-something BCE when Plato, Confucius, the Buddha, Second Isaiah, all were living at the same time. And there was a tremendous religious intellectual ferment going on. So it may be that the author of Job, who, by the way, did not write the first chapter is an atrocity. The first chapter exists to pose the question and then be discarded. And I know there are a lot of people who set out to read the book of Job, read chapter 1, where Job's suffering is explained by God making a bet with Satan.
Yeah.
Let's torment this guy and see if that'll make him give up his faith.
Right.
I mean, who would ever believe in a God who plays games like that? Well, somewhere around, 500, give or take, BCE, this brilliant author, poet, thinker, saw that maybe something bad had happened to him and somebody gave him that fable, said, this is garbage. And he turns it inside out and he writes this philosophical, theological poem in which Job does get angry and Job does protest. And three friends try and comfort him with the traditional theology. And to the author's credit, these three friends are not stick figures. They make a very persuasive case for the traditional God. One of them says, Job, you're a good person, but you're not perfect. Can you admit that? Good. Okay. God punishes people for the wrong things they do and rewards them for the right things they do. Unless you're going to sit there and tell us you've never done anything wrong, you've got no grounds for complaint. Job, interestingly, doesn't disagree with that. He says, okay, I could be happy in a world where God gave people what they deserve if he would only tell me what sin am I being punished for, because I've tried and I can't think of any. And if he doesn't tell me what I'm being punished for, how am I supposed to change and repent? That's the first round of argument. Mm-hmm. Second round, Job's friend makes a very interesting case. He says, and I'm going to paraphrase it now for contemporary understanding. He says, Job, can you understand people don't go to church or synagogue for a theology seminar? They go to be reassured that we have a loving God in heaven. That's what gives us the freedom to go to sleep at night and not worry that something will happen to the world overnight. That's what gives us the courage to bring children into this world and raise them, the assumption that God will take care of good people. Are you, on the basis of your one atypical week of bad experiences, are you going to steal that from God? Can't you pretend to believe in a God who cares for us as we deserve, just so everybody else can go on believing him? And Job says, no, I'm not going to lie to God. I'm not going to lie about God. And then he says in chapter 6, and I think it's one of the great statements in the entire Bible, Job says, if God is as great as you keep telling me he is, he will appreciate my honesty more than your flattery. Job is saying, I'm not the one who is attacking God. I'm the one who is speaking on God's behalf. I want to uphold the idea that he is a just and fair God who gives people what they deserve. And all I want him to do is make sense of what happened to me last week so that I can go on believing that.
So what are we to do? I want to work through through the poem part of Job.
Sure.
I don't want to get too hung up on that first part of Job, the fable, which you say is distasteful. It's distasteful to a lot of people, the basics behind it. But it does seem to be the thing that people get caught up by. And there's another troubling story in the Bible you write about where, of course, you do wonder about the nature or the intention of God. It's the part where God puts Abraham to the test, asks him to sacrifice his son Isaac, offer him as a burnt offering. How are we supposed to understand that story?
Oh, God, I wish I could just skip that chapter. But the burden of being a rabbi is we not only find it in chapter 22 of Genesis, we are compelled to read it on the second day of the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah when the entire synagogue is full. And I have to try and make sense of it. No, I hate that story. I don't know who comes across worse, God for demanding the sacrifice of Abraham's son or Abraham for going along with it.
Yeah.
I would have wanted an Abraham who protested the way Job protested. You know what I think that story is about? Theodor Reich, a psychoanalyst who was a disciple, an early disciple of Freud, I think he nailed it. He said, what you have is what you have in many early societies, a coming-of-age ordeal for a young man on the cusp of adolescence. That is, in so many old societies, whether in the Near East, in South America, in Africa, when a boy is almost an adult on the verge of adolescence, he has to go through a life-threatening ordeal. Maybe he has to go and kill a wild animal. Maybe he has to spend a week foraging for food in the wilderness. Maybe he has to stay awake for 3 nights or something. He has to show he's worthy of being an adult. I think at the heart of the Binding of Isaac story is that this was a test to see if Isaac was man enough to go through this. And later on, it was recast as a story of Abraham's unquestioning obedience, because the story fell into the hands of religious leaders, authorities, for whom religion was defined as unquestioning obedience. Now, I'm sorry, that's not my religion. My respect for my own moral sense requires me to challenge God when I think God is being immoral, to look into it carefully, to try and understand it, to give God the benefit of every doubt, but not to assume that when something is said in God's name, it must be true because it's said in God's name. What I say to my congregation in Natick now, when we read that story on Rosh Hashanah, is if you read it carefully, God speaks to Abraham twice. The first time he says, kill the boy as a sacrifice, and the second time he says, don't lay your hands on him.
Yeah.
What Abraham has to do is decide which of those two messages is the authentic voice of God. Now, that's something I can relate to. We hear a lot of things said in the name of God. Some of them we are moved and impressed by, and some of them we are troubled by. There are people who preach hatred for other religions. There are people who preach hatred for other races, other nations, for homosexuals, for mentally retarded, in the name of God. And I reject that. I don't believe that these people are speaking for God. I believe God's message is a message of inclusiveness, of kindness, of reaching out, of embracing, of seeing every human being as fashioned somehow in the image of God. But you see, we hear these two messages, and we, like Abraham, are asked to decide which one is the authentic voice of God. That's all I could do with the story, but again, I wish it weren't there.
Can you apply that to the Jobs, or at least the Job fable? I mean, because you have the God of the Job fable who prizes unquestioning loyalty, doesn't, you know, won't hear of criticism, is all-powerful, is all-controlling, needs spies.
This God needs a whole lot of ego stroking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that flatters God. No, I reject chapter one of Job as being a message about God that I cannot accept. And I, you know, if God is like that, I want nothing to do with him. And then I read chapters 3 through 41, hard as they are to understand, as trying to make out a case for God. But in the final answer, the final answer I come away with from the book of Job is our job is not to understand God. Our job is to experience God. And what finally answers Job, you realize when God appears in chapter 38, he does not come down to answer Job's questions. The first thing God says, in effect, is, I'll ask the questions around here, young man. Do you know how to make a world? I made a world. Could you do that? This is not just putting Job in his place. This is saying the real answer to the question of human suffering is not to understand God's role, but to discern God's presence. Let me tell you a story. This is maybe the most important personal story I have outside of my son's illness and death. This is the day I learned how to be an effective rabbi. We got a call at the temple office that there'd been a death in the congregation. I raced down to the house to try and make people feel better. I walk in, they jump on me. They say, Rabbi, why would God let this happen to such a good person? And I thought they were asking me about God. So I give them a long, involved theological explanation, and their eyes sort of glaze over. So at that point, I had this flash of understanding. When someone says, why does God permit this in the wake of a personal tragedy, not in the context of a theological seminar, but in the wake of a personal tragedy, why did God let this happen is not a question. It is a cry of pain. And the best response to the person who in their pain cries out, where is God? Why did he do this to me? Is not to explain God's role, as Job's three friends try to do, but to hug them and dry their tears and hold their hands and not try to make sense of it, because that is outrageous. And any time you try to make sense of the tragedy, you end up saying, if not in words, at least in tone, you deserved it. And that's not helpful. I became a better rabbi now when I explained less and I hugged more. I would go to a home where there had been a loss. I didn't know what to say, so I would sit there and not say anything. And the bereaved family would sit there and they wouldn't say anything. And I'd sit quietly and they'd sit quietly. And after 15 minutes of sitting and holding their hands and not speaking, I got up to go and they would hug me. They would say, Rabbi, thank you. I can't tell you what this has meant to us. Because what people really want when they say, how could God let this happen, is not a learned explanation. They want the reassurance that they are worth caring about. They want me as the local incarnation of the presence of God. They want me to come in and hug them and hold their hand and dry their tears as if to say, this is what God is doing to you, for you, through me. He's not the one who's striking you. He's the one who's trying to heal you.
So is it a way of us maybe reconfiguring our own nature? Because you yourself write about how human beings are meaning makers. You know, we look for patterns. We try to understand the world in terms of cause and effect. We want the world to make sense. So we have to reorder our expectations?
Yeah, I think so. I think we have to decide that there are some questions which we will never come up with a suitable answer for. And rather than settle for second best and come up with a couldn't think of anything better type answer, which leaves us very ambivalent about God and the nature of religion, and you end up with a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens, because they looked for left brain answers to life experiences and they couldn't find any good ones. And they were right. There are no good answers. I'm offering right brain experiences. I'm offering an emotional response. My hero is Viktor Frankl, who survived Auschwitz and wrote one of the great books of the 20th century about his experience, Man's Search for Meaning. And at the heart of that book is one line. He says, we cannot control what the world does to us. We can always control how we will respond to what the world does to us. That is, Frankl, who lost so much and endured so much in the Holocaust, his response was not to ask how could human beings do that to their neighbors, but to say, I will not let that distort my notion of what it means to be a human being. And this is what I say to people. Our job in the wake of this terrible thing that's happened to you is not to make sense of it, because any effort to make sense will either demean you or demean your relative who died or demean God. And what have you gained if you do that? Our response is to look within ourselves for the strength to go on affirming life. And when we find it, we will know it was God who put it there.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Lindy, who is with us in Pleasant Grove. Lindy, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Doug. And thank you, Rabbi Kushner, for your splendid work. I'm so appreciative of it. I wonder if you would respond to a spiritual intuition that I've had for many years.
Love to
and
hear it.
That is, forgive me. That is that far from God imposing his will on me and forcing me to go through trials and difficulties, I have a strong feeling that I, as an eternal and sentient being, decided with him, together with him, we organized the opportunities and difficulties and trials of my life so that I could deepen my soul. Because I just believe that the chasms for pain and suffering in this life are necessarily deep and wide, that there may be room for the joy, the increased compassion and understanding that comes in the morning. And I wonder if you would respond to that or if there's anything in your intuition or tradition that correlates with that idea.
Lindy, thank you so much for that. That's a lovely statement. I would go along with a lot of that. That is, I would go along with the sense that, well, let me give you an example. Jews are celebrating Passover next Monday night with the Seder. And one of the things that happens at the Seder is that we eat a bitter herb as a reminder of the slavery in Egypt. My sermon for Passover is going to be about the fact that there are times in our lives where we choose to eat the bitter herb because we have to accept the unpleasantnesses as part of life, the limitations of our humanity, the fact that there are people who love who will not love us back, the fact there are people who will take advantage of us. and that we grow because of our eating of the bitter herb. The one place where I would part from what you said, and I'm not saying you're wrong, I'm just saying that's not me, is the hint that when misfortune comes, we have welcomed it into our lives. I would say that about myself and a lot of the bad things that happened to me. I am incapable of saying that about my child. He was an innocent child who was born in a situation which would condemn him to physical and emotional pain every day of his life. And to say it was something he chose or something we chose for him, that's more than I'm prepared to say. Again, I'm not saying you're wrong, Lindy. I'm just saying it doesn't work for me.
Lindy, glad you called. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rabbi Harold Kushner is with us. His latest book is The Book of Job, When Bad Things Happen to a Good Person. And we need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Rabbi Harold Kushner. His latest book is called The Book of Job, When Bad Things Happen to a Good Person. 801-585-WEST, our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. John is with us in Park City, Utah. John, welcome.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Kushner, I really, really enjoyed and was intrigued that God doesn't really enter and make things happen that way to a person, but gives the opportunity for us to respond to a crisis, if I understand what you were saying.
Yes, you do.
My question is, would you comment on just the opposite of that? When good things happen to a bad person, for example, you have a person that's, let's say, bad for whatever reason, and they win a lottery ticket of $10 million. This is an opportunity, in a sense, to maybe associate with someone that good fortune came and they didn't deserve it. How would you look at that and comment on it? I'll take my question off the air.
First of all, John, would it make you feel better if I told you there is extensive psychological research that people who win big in the lottery feel wonderful for 6 months, and then they go back to being exactly who they were before they won?
Right.
This is, seriously, there's it's beyond dispute right now that it doesn't last. Secondly, lottery is purely a matter of chance. You don't increase your odds of winning by deserving it, and you don't decrease your odds of winning by not deserving it. The only way to respond is to say somebody's good fortune. It's not only a lottery. Think of people who are blessed with amazing athletic ability and don't deserve the kind of fame and fortune we shower on them. Think of people who are born gorgeous looking and have people slavering over them and don't have the personality or the kindness to deserve that kind of attention. Think of all the college and high school girls who at this moment are wondering why God is so arbitrary in his distribution of good looks. These things are just matters of genetics, and God's role, as we've been saying, is not to control everything, but to the Viktor Frankl message, to give us the capacity to respond to God's blessings, to the world's blessings, and to the world's unfairness. By the way, the subset of that, two subsets, John. First, a lot of people have asked me, why don't you write a book about when good things happen to bad people? And my response would be, who would buy it? Who would look at that and say, hey, I got to read that. That's the story of my life. But the other problem is it raises a question about prayer. People who buy a lottery ticket and pray that they have the winning ticket. And they talk about all the good things they will do, the charity they will give, the help for the church, the problems that they will solve in the world. And it doesn't increase their chance of winning because I think, well, for one thing, I think we've grown up with a misconstruing of the nature of prayer. You know what we've done in this country? We have confused God with Santa Claus, and we approach prayer as if we were writing to Santa Claus, I've been a good boy or girl, and here are the things I want, and this is why I deserve them. And that's not prayer. Prayer is simply a response to the wonder of coming into the presence of God. It's not petition. It's not begging. It's not doing business with God.
So it's not inviting God to intervene in our life.
Well, yeah, to intervene within the limits of what God does.
Right.
He intervenes not by giving us a winning lottery ticket, but by helping us understand that there are things we can do with our lives even if we don't hit it big in the lottery.
John, thanks. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Andrew is with us in Salt Lake City. Andrew, welcome.
Hi. I was just going to comment. I got cancer when I was 22 years old after I'd been married for 4 months, and I kind of see the whole experience as bringing us all together and showing the love we have for each other and giving them a chance to prove that love to me and to everybody else involved. I just think that it was overall a good thing, even though I was had a bone marrow transplant and very close to death many times, but it was still a positive thing to me.
Rabbi, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right that the cancer didn't make you a better person. The experience of coping with it, finding people who cared about you, from the doctors to the friends to everyone else, that made you a better person. I can go along with that. You know, a couple of years ago, you may remember, they did this experiment to see whether prayer helps people heal.
Yeah.
Do you recall? They took a large cohort of post-surgical patients, divided them to three even groups. One group was prayed for, one group was not prayed for, and the third group didn't know if they were prayed for or not. Turned out it didn't make any difference. A television station asked me about that, and I said, well, you know, it's not God's business to make sick people healthy. That's the doctor's business. God's business is making sick people brave, and that is something God does very well. And that is something I think our caller experienced when it was, you know, his return to health was in the hands of doctors. His own inner strength, his faith, the willingness of people to hold his hand, to encourage him, to tell him that they cared about him, which I will tell you from my pastoral experience is not an easy thing to do. I have to summon up a lot of faith and strength when I go to the hospital to visit the room of somebody I know well and like, and I know that person is desperately ill and may not survive. It's not a fun thing to do, but somehow I feel I am incarnating the loving presence of God when I do that.
Andrew, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number. Back to the phones. Ashley is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, Ashley.
Yeah, hi. So my question was, you know, it was interesting to hear about, you know, the Jews with the eating of the bitter herb and the suffering that people have to endure. That's just something that maybe we need to be okay with. But I wonder if your guests maybe can see how religion in some circumstances can almost seem like a tool of oppression, because it convinces people that they should be okay with, you know, injustices and hard things in their life instead of rising up and challenging the system.
It's a good question. But you say Job does rise up, Rabbi Kushner, and challenge the system for a time.
He
anyway.
Does, as I did with my first book. Absolutely. No, I'm not in favor of accepting this. What I'm saying is that the real purpose of religion is not to explain it, but to respond to it, and to give us the strength to respond to it, and to give us the moral energy and the friends endorsing what we said. No, I don't want anybody to say, I guess this happened because I deserved it. Yeah, your caller talked about how religion can turn into an object of oppression. And boy, is she absolutely right. It's terrible. It's terrible what people do in the name of religion. The way women are treated in religion, the way gays are treated, the way African-Americans were treated for so many years, the way bad-looking people were treated, the way they are shunned. God must have his reasons for making them outcasts or striking them with mental illness. No, religion in the wrong hands becomes an instrument of repression. I mean, where did we get the word inquisition from? A religion properly understood gives people the strength to stand up to that and to say, no, my religion is about whom I'm required to love, not whom I'm entitled to hate.
Thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Here's a question, an email from Tim, who writes, how do you perceive an atheist who does good and believes he is doing good from his own heart? How do you explain that?
There is a term that is used in religious conversation called conversion by definition.
Right.
That is, I would say about that. You know, I used to say to that person, well, if you give charity and you do good to the poor and you're honest, you're not really an atheist. But that's, you know, that gets into word games. No, I would say what he does is wonderful and he should keep on doing it. And I have no complaints. And I don't think God really is offended by his not affirming his belief in God, as long as he believes in the good things that God stands for. My question would be, all right, here is this polite, charming, charitable, honest, well-educated, articulate atheist who can handle all the good things in his life without pausing to thank God for them. What's going to happen when he runs out of good things? What's going to happen when he has a sick child? What's going to happen when he comes down with cancer? What's going to happen when his marriage breaks up, when his company goes broke because somebody he trusted was dishonest? Where will he find the faith to go on caring for the things he has always stood for if he has no place to look for that transfusion of faith except to look deeper inside himself because he doesn't believe there's a source for it outside of himself? And if he finds in the universe a reinforcement, a replenishment of the will to go on bravely and honestly, I would question whether he's really an atheist or just playing with words.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Another Andrew with us in Salt Lake City. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
33 years ago, my wife and I lost a young son to spinal meningitis after 48 hours of illness. And we had by the grace of God, that very afternoon, we turned to each other and said, we can be thankful we had him or bitter that we lost him. Now we've been married 40 years. And we've often wondered how we might come alongside a young couple or others who have been, you know, been in the same circumstance but maybe have dealt with it differently. And I would ask that question. Is there a forum or someplace where we might be a support?
Yeah, that's something I can speak to out of personal experience. I have used the experience of the death of our son as a way of giving strength to others, not by saying to them, hey, we got through this, you can get through it too, but by saying, I know what you're going through. I know the pain you feel. I know how bleak the future looks today. Please learn from my experience that what you're feeling today is not what you'll always feel. There will be time where you will be less conscious of your child's loss and more conscious of his life, where you will find him an enduring presence. Let's see, our son died in 1977. That means it's going on 36 years since he died. In those 36 years, I don't think there has been a single day that I have not paused to think about him. But what I thought about changed in the course of those 36 years. In the beginning, it was only how much it hurts and how much I miss him. Now when I think about him, it's what a remarkable soul he was. How miraculously he coped with what he had to cope with, and how he has made my wife and myself better people because he handled his illness the way he did, and because he was part of our lives for 14 years. That changes, as I suspect that has changed for Andrew as he looks back over the progression. You still miss your son, it still hurts, but somehow it hurts differently than it did way back then.
About a minute, a little more than a minute left. Rabbi, I wanted to ask you, there's a story you tell about how when Abraham came to believe in God, he was walking in the wilderness and he saw this palace lit up by fire, and he asks, does someone live in that palace? You use this as a way to sort of come back to the question of God and contact with God. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Oh, this is one of the famous stories in Jewish theological rabbinic teaching. What does it mean that the palace was lit up by fire? There are two interpretations. One, the lights were on. You know, there were torches in every window. Somebody lived there. We look at the world. It is so orderly and precise, we say there must be an intelligence behind it. For decades, that was the view I had. The second interpretation is the palace was on fire, was burning down. Abram looks at it and says, what a wonderful palace. It's too bad. There's nobody there to take care of it. At that point, God appears and says, I am the Lord of this palace. That is, seeing a world in flames, seeing a world filled with cruelty and malice and fraud, Abram and we wonder, where is God in this world? And the only answer is not to explain why there's fraud, but to encounter God's presence. Just as the author of the 23rd Psalm says, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I feel no evil, for thou art with me. Not because thou hast taught me to understand the need for evil, not because thou explained to me why I deserve this, but simply because you're there. And Abram sees the presence of God and says, I don't find the burning palace to be quite as dispiriting as it did a moment ago.
That's Rabbi Harold Kushner. His latest book, The Book of Job, When Bad Things Happen to a Good Person, joined us today from Watertown, Massachusetts. Rabbi, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for reaching out to me.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.